this House Water Committee, Water Committee meeting, Wednesday, February 14th. February 16th, I beg your pardon. And one announcement before we begin. House Bill 2025 is being set over until Friday for work session. We're moving on with our agenda. At this point, we have an informational meeting, and this is a continuation of presentation as was made by the Water Resource Department a few days ago. And the informational meeting on Critical Groundwater Task Force presentation. Have with us today from the great House District 58 in Umatilla County, Mr. Harmon Springer and Dr. Gary Reed. I see from the Umatilla County Planning Department, I believe, Tamara Maddock. Are you going to join us here? You're just listening? Okay, welcome. Glad to have you in the building today. And with that, Gary and Harmon, could you come up to the and for the record, please introduce yourselves. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm Harmon Springer.
I'm Gary Reed. I'm superintendent of the OSU Agricultural Experiment Station at Hermiston and a member of the Water Task Force.
Thank you.
And Chairman Jensen, members of the committee, as I have just indicated, I'm Harmon Springer. I live at 610 West Moore Avenue in Hermiston, Oregon. I'm a member of the Hermiston City Council and as such represent the city of Hermiston on the Umatilla County Critical Groundwater Task Force as vice chair. I'm also the secretary of the Oregon Water Coalition, an organization that promotes the wise use of Oregon's water resources. I'd like to take a few moments to bring you up to date on what the task force is all about. The task force was formed to deal with one of six critical groundwater areas in the state, by far the largest. And the critical groundwater areas that we're dealing with in Umatilla County are the Ordnance critical groundwater area, the Butter Creek critical groundwater area, and the Stage Gulch critical groundwater area. That's an area of about 600 square miles in western Umatilla County. The other critical groundwater areas in the state are Cooper Mountain, Bull Mountain critical groundwater area at the Beaverton, Tualatin area, the Dalles critical groundwater area in Wasco County, and the Cow Valley critical groundwater area in North Malheur County. There are some additional areas in the lower Willamette Valley are designated as limited, but not critical. Of these critical groundwater areas, the Ordnance, which by name you can identify as being out at the Umatilla Army Depot, now known as the Umatilla Chemical Depot, that's a Army reservation of, I believe, 25,000 acres. That critical groundwater area, the Ordnance critical groundwater area, takes in that and a whole lot of other territory. The Butter Creek critical groundwater area represents the area from the Columbia River in a north-south configuration about 30 miles south along Butter Creek, south of Hermiston and Echo. And the Stage Gulch critical groundwater area goes east of Stanfield, And it's about, goes about 20 miles east towards Pendleton. I would like to give you a description of what it's like underground. On our task force, we have had an opportunity in the last year to hear presentations from geologists and people from various departments in the state of Oregon. We've gotten a whole lot of information. But one piece of information that was very helpful to us was to try to understand what the critical groundwater area is like, what the view of things are underground. So we had a presentation at one of our task force meetings by Terry Tolan, who was a geologist working with the Westinghouse Company many years ago, and I'll refer to him in my presentation. In a special paper published by the Geological Society of America and co-edited by Dr. Steve Rydell of Westinghouse and P.R. Hooper of Washington State University, the basalt lava flows of eastern Washington, Oregon, and western Idaho are proven to be the largest lava flows in the world. And you can see that when you go through the gorge, for example. You see many layers of lava from the tall bluffs right on down to the river. Called flood basalts, the lava spilled out of giant fissures in the Earth's crust. This was, in geologic times, they believed 16 million years ago, before the Cascade Mountains existed and before the Blue Mountains developed as they are today. The study of the Columbia basalt flows began in the 1960s, but most of the information contained in the report was generated during the Basalt Waste Isolation Project, when Hanford was considered as a potential site for high-level nuclear waste repository. Rydell says that one of the largest flood basalt flows extends from north-central Idaho all the way to Portland, covering nearly 20,000 square miles. This was a startling discovery because geologists had no idea that the flows were that large prior to the work that they did at Hanford. The four flows occurred over a short period of time, perhaps no more than 500 years, and each spreading its lava over 10,000 square miles, sometimes within a week's time. So it was liquid lava that was flowing toward the sea. Most of the large lava flows were erupted within just a few weeks' time. The gigantic flows destroyed everything, of course, in its path. Temperatures of the erupted lava were between 2200 and 2300 degrees Fahrenheit. And that created, of course, a huge heat problem. But rising heat would be hit by Pacific storms, resulting in torrential rains and so forth. All told, the flood basalts of the Columbia Basin covered more than 62,000 square miles. Almost 90% of the basalt emerged in geologic times 15 to 16 million years ago, but the basalt floods continued in one form or another until about 6 million years ago. The flood basalt flows beneath the Columbia Basin, and this is the part that really got my attention. We have basalt up to 2.5 miles deep in eastern Oregon and eastern Washington. And in fact, Terry Tolan told us that right at Hermiston, in this critical groundwater that we're dealing with, the basalt is 2.5 miles thick. The interesting thing is that it came in various layers, as I've mentioned, and with each of these layers, which you can see going through the gorge or where they have cut roadways, you can see the different layers of the material, the basalt material. And between those layers, sometimes you see stuff that's kind of granulated like gravel or whatever. And those areas either were foam or gas bubbles on the top of the lava flow when it first occurred, or in the process of time afterwards, other material blowing in by the storms and so forth. By the time the next lava flow came along, and that happening with every layer. Now, the lava flows themselves are like concrete. The water cannot go through the lava flow unless those lava flows crack, which they do in lots of areas, and then the water can percolate down through the cracks. And the aquifers are really that porous part of the layers that was on the top. So when well drillers go through the basalt, they hit those areas that are kind of porous, and that's where they find the water. Now, obviously, the water that is flowing through various aquifers in the basalt 2 miles down are not coming out into the Columbia River there. In fact, they will not be coming out of the Columbia River anywhere because Hermiston is not 2.5 miles above the sea. So maybe it's helping to replenish the seawater or something. But anyway, so that gives you a little bit, I hope it gives you a little bit of an idea of the sandwiching effect of all these different lava flows, and that the aquifers for the water that we're dealing with and that we're drilling wells into and that we are depleting or not depleting, it's recharging or not recharging, are basically in those layers. There is a lot of water, however, underground in Oregon. And the statistics that I was able to find, the most recent was January of 2003, approximately 20,000 wells in the state of Oregon. And that includes exempt wells. And in that same year, there were a total of 16,367 water rights issued by the Water Resources Department, producing approximately 1.2 million acre-feet of water per year.
Excuse me, Hyman, if I could. I think in your written testimony, you have 200,000 wells, and you said 20,000.
I'm sorry, 200,000.
Oh, okay. There are 200,000 wells.
Yes, in the state.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I just wanted to make sure we were right on that.
The wells in that year, and it's probably very similar this year, 84% of well water is used for irrigation in the state. Industry and commerce taking 2%, and cities taking 8% of the well water. Giving you a little history of the Critical Groundwater Task Force, which Gary and I are members of. In the fall of 2003, the Umatilla County Department of Resources and Development, in other words, the Planning Department, notified rural landowners in the critical groundwater areas, which is a 600-square-mile area on the west side of Umatilla County, including the cities of Hermiston, Umatilla, Stanfield, and Echo, and 160,000 acres of irrigated farmland. The Planning Department notified folks in the country of a proposed rural land use regulation that would affect the permissible use of the owner's land. The notice said, quote, Umatilla County proposes to adopt ordinance number 2003-11, amending the Umatilla County Development Code to add sections to create a critical groundwater overlay zone. The amendment would restrict development that is dependent on the use of groundwater within the Oregon Water Resources Department's designated critical groundwater area. This critical groundwater area are described as the ones I mentioned earlier, ordinance, basalt and gravel, Butter Creek basalt, and Stage Gulch basalt. As a result of an order of the Land Conservation Development Commission, Umatilla County has proposed ordinance number 2003-11 to bring county land usage regulations into compliance with statewide planning goal number 5. Umatilla County has determined that the adoption of this ordinance will affect the permissible uses of your property and may reduce the value of your property. So that was the message that was sent to rural residents in Umatilla County, in West Umatilla County. And it announced that there would be a hearing held at the National Guard Armory in Hermiston on October 23rd, 2003. During the hearing, the Umatilla County Planning Commission voted at that hearing not to proceed to adopt the proposed ordinance that I just read to you, and called on the County Commission to form a critical groundwater task force to identify and implement technically and economically feasible measures to enhance and protect groundwater quantity and quality through the year 2050. As an essential natural resource necessary to assure continued economic development in Umatilla County, especially in the designated critical groundwater areas. The Umatilla County Critical Groundwater Task Force was created by order of the Umatilla County Board of Commissioners on January 5th, 2004, and it's made up of 20 members, which we have met on a monthly basis. Now, to give you an idea of some of the material that we have discussed in the last year, one of the items was a 50-50 funding arrangement for a new Umatilla Basin watershed study by the U.S. Geological Survey to include all of Umatilla and portions of Marl County. The study has an estimated cost of $4 million and would provide an up-to-date map of the geological situation there in that area. Other discussions of Upper Umatilla River impoundments, such as some dams up the Umatilla River, the potential for impounding water there for replacement of irrigation water, various ideas for artificial recharge of the two kinds of aquifers that we have, alluvial and basaltic aquifers, by impounding Columbia River water during the winter off-season in gravel pits, recharge wells, idle feeder canals, and by flooding farmland, and to determine if irrigation districts infrastructure might be available to assist in these artificial recharge projects. We discussed expanded use of treated municipal wastewater for irrigation and artificial recharge purposes. And a lot of that is happening at all times. All septic systems are, believe it or not, recharging back into the ground. The cities of Hermiston, Umatilla, Stanfield, and Echo account for approximately 24,000 residents, and the rural population is almost the same number in western Umatilla County. Several countywide development corporations' concepts for permitted surface water piped from the Columbia River to supplement or replace wells for irrigation, tribal, municipal, and industrial purposes. And the creation of the possibility of the creation of a regional rural water district to provide a piped drinking water delivery system to rural residents in the critical groundwater zones. This is a proven solution for rural domestic water needs in a number of states in the Midwest and East. It is easy to measure the success, satisfaction, and costs of such a project. There are between 4,000 and 5,000 rural homes and businesses needing domestic water services inside the critical groundwater zones in Umatilla County. On the subject of rural residential and exempt water use resolution and recommendations, the Umatilla County Critical Groundwater Task Force prepared this resolution. This was part of a recommendation portion of the resolution, which we have produced. The Umatilla County Critical Groundwater Task Force hereby recommends to the Umatilla County Board of Commissioners to confirm the following interim policy in partial fulfillment of its objectives and mission. Until a 2050 plan is developed to direct development, allocation, and management of groundwater in the Umatilla River Basin in Umatilla County, the citizens within the critical areas may continue to install exempt wells as authorized by state statute and as they have been historically allowed to do. In the interim, applicants to Umatilla County for zoning permits, land partitions, and rural subdivisions will not be required to pay impact fees, conduct water availability studies, provide mitigation measures, or have any other domestic water supply condition imposed on them by the county until a 2050 plan is developed or as duly authorized by county ordinance. Insofar as the county is required to adopt findings to approve land use permits, the county will rely on this document to defend the assumption that new exempt wells do not make a significant adverse impact on the groundwater resource. The county will assume exempt wells are appropriate and permissible. In the event that adjoining property owners or other interested parties raise concerns about a potential negative impact to groundwater supply for a proposed development, the county will continue to defer to the OWRD, the Oregon Water Resources Department. The county will rely on the findings in this document when reviewing land use decisions that include development of exempt wells. Until such a time as the county is granted authority to manage or regulate water use, claims about well interference and inadequate water supply shall not be treated as a land use matter and shall be deferred to the Oregon Water Resources Department for regulation under Oregon law, Oregon water law. Now, on the 24th of February, the Umatilla County Board of Commissioners will take action on this recommendation that the task force presented to them, either accepting it, amending it, or denying it. We should know on the 24th of February what that will be. I would like to give you just a little bit more information on one of the areas that we've had important input from a company that has been doing work in North Dakota where they have been forced by the lack of water and the poor quality of water to develop a system of water from delivery from the Missouri River. And we've had Bill Leinard from Boise, Idaho. His firm is working on a project to bring municipal type water to the northwest quarter of the state of North Dakota. And he gave us some information on how that goes. Our situation in Hermiston is similar in some respects to that in North Dakota, but a lot different in some respects. It's a smaller area. It has half the capacity to produce the water already in the regional water system at Hermiston. It has a population of about 11,000 people and a density which is 60 to 150 times more dense than it is in North Dakota. If in the future a municipal type piped water system were to be approved and sold to the public and created, it would be feasible. And it would take people off of wells. There are thousands of wells in this region. We don't know how many. We know that there are There are 4,400 residences and businesses in the area, all of them probably having at least one well.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. And I apologize if you already stated about this question, the response to this question, but because I'm not as familiar with the critical groundwater determination for the Umatilla, but I'm assuming that that was issued because of groundwater shortages or concern about depletion of the aquifer. Is that correct?
What is happening is that the aquifers are going down. And the biggest users of water from the aquifer is irrigation. So the critical groundwater task force will determine, try to determine, come up with ideas of how to supply water from some other source than from the aquifer.
Okay, follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Dingfelder.
So I just want to get a sense of if I'm understanding this right. So what the findings were that the county held off on implementing this ordinance, is that correct,
mm-hmm.
until the task force was finished doing a study and make a recommendation about how to recharge the aquifer, and you're looking at a range of options,
mm-hmm.
including injection as
That's correct.
Wastewater treatment and also getting water during the winter and
right.
injecting it. And so in the meantime, do any new wells have to be do they have to be approved by Water Resources Department? Is that how it's happening right now?
Oregon law allows exempt wells.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody can punch a hole in the ground on their piece of property. And there are no statistics as to how many of those wells there are. It has, however, been agreed by the task force that represents a very small part of the use of the water. Most of the water goes to irrigation.
And another follow-up. What about, you didn't say in here, unless I misread, about any new irrigation wells for irrigation purposes.
There are no new irrigation wells going in at this time that I'm aware of. Is that correct, Gary?
That's correct. In the critical areas, there haven't been new wells permitted for a long time.
Okay. So any new wells that are going in are primarily for domestic, industrial, commercial, and they fall in the exempt category if they're under certain gallons and acreage,
yeah.
correct?
And what I might point out to you that those wells are all permitted wells, and when aquifer conditions dictate, the Water Resources Department makes every well user, they set the amount of water they can use. So those irrigation wells, for the most part, are producing under 50% of their permit.
Some much less than that.
Okay. Are you satisfied, Representative Trump?
Yeah, I would like to ask Sandy, though, if we can get a copy of the critical groundwater study, and I'm assuming that Water Resources Department can provide that to us. I see Adam shaking his head.
Yeah, I have some of that with me here. I have the full task force resolution and the recommendations, so I'll give you that copy.
Great, thank you.
That'd be great, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's the depth of this aquifer that you're talking about? You may have told us, but I...
Well, you know, the aquifers vary.
Yeah.
You know, the well driller knows. The well driller knows where the water is. He goes down and he finds it, and he goes a little further and he can't find it.
Many of the wells are, of course, as in any area, you've got variable heights of where you're drilling from, and they're considering depth from where they're drilling.
Oh.
But many of the wells in this area for irrigation are beyond 500 feet. A lot of them
excuse me, Gary, before you go on, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, I'm Gary Reed. I'm superintendent of the Agricultural Experiment Station for Oregon State University at Hermiston, Oregon.
Thank you.
The wells that are used primarily for agriculture in that 500 to 900 foot range. Most of the residential wells are not that deep yet, but there are some that are in that depth already.
Follow up. I'll go ahead and follow up.
Follow up, Representative Brown. Go ahead.
And the irrigators are using most of the water, and they got the wells at the deepest level. It must be creating some problems for the domestic users, for the farmhouse that just got a domestic well.
Domestic wells that have been having problems are primarily in the surface alluvial aquifer. And what's happening with that is they are just simply overusing the amount that's there. And those amounts have been historically sustained by irrigation on the alluvial ground adjacent to it. And so they've been actually using irrigation water for residential use. And in the last 15 to 20 years, we've got to the point where there is no water getting into that aquifer from irrigation. The efficiency has been increased to the point where there's no longer return flow. And so they're finding they have to drill deeper and deeper. And that's even putting many of them into the basalt aquifers also.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, now that we've scared off half the committee, I have another question, and I don't have to ask anybody. So regarding, as a follow-up to Representative Brown's question, if a domestic well owner finds out that they do have to drill deeper, I mean, does anybody compensate them? You know, we've been talking a lot about Measure 37 and the costs of not being able to develop fully. Are there any funds to compensate a homeowner if they have to go ahead and drill deeper because the aquifer is being drawn down by other sources?
There is not, but there's not also within state law a guarantee that there's water in the well that they've got. So there's some protection against Measure 37 in that particular set of legislation.
So they just take on the cost. That's just the cost of having your own well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And that is a substantial cost in many cases, oftentimes $6,000 to $10,000.
Okay, thank you. And one other question regarding the public water supply option. Dean, what's the time frame on that?
When it might be done, or?
Or, I mean, are there plans in place? Is there a study, feasibility study being done? Or?
Actually, what we're doing on this task force is creating some ideas, gathering information, and writing proposals which will go to the county commissioners, and from there, you know, decisions can be made what course of action to take.
Thank you.
Representative
Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then the regional rural water district hasn't been formed yet?
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you. Do you have any more testimony, or?
I would just like to briefly say Oregon is going to face this in probably 80% of the land that we have. It's going to be faced within, I suspect, at least the next 4 to 5 decades, and in some cases much sooner. The responsibilities of this committee are massive when you consider it. You're going to write the future of Oregon, because water is going to define what's here. It's not going to be defined on what kind of capital we've got. It's not going to be defined on what taxation we've got. It's going to be defined on how well we manage the water resource. And the issues we're facing, we're finding, are much worse than we anticipated they would be. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. I appreciate it.
I'll leave you some material here.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Anybody else like to testify on that?
No, just a presentation.
Okay.
So we got word on the public.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2172. And Sandy?
Adam Sussman
from the Water Resources Department will provide us an overview. And then we have quite a few people signed up on both sides of the issue. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Adam Sussman. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator with the Water Resources Department, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide an overview and some testimony on House Bill 2172. By way of introduction, refresh your memory. This bill was actually a committee bill that was introduced by the House Interim Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources on behalf of the Interim Subcommittee on Water, and there was a fair amount of discussion during the interim on this issue. And again, just by way of introduction, what this bill does in a nutshell is addresses the issue of voluntary water right cancellations within an irrigation district. I mean, in a nutshell, that's what it does, and I'll get into the details in a minute. But there's one point that I want to make up front about this bill, is that this bill makes no declaration of water right ownership. And as I get into my testimony more, you'll understand why that point is very significant. And the other thing that it does not do, it does not alter in any way an individual water right holder's right to act in a unilateral fashion if he or she is so inclined to give up their interest in their water right. So I also want to let the committee know that the department does support the efforts of the Notice and Concurrence Work Group that put these concepts together, and we do support the concepts in House Bill 2172. Having said that, I also know that there are stakeholders that are actively discussing potential amendments to the bill, and of course we would support that effort and would be interested in participating. So why are we here with this bill? By way of a little bit of background, during the last legislative session, some of you may recall that there was a fair amount of debate over what was termed water right ownership, who owned a water right. And at the end of that session, after the various bills didn't make it through the process, the department committed to put together a work group and see if we could make some headway on resolving this issue. And what we really wanted to focus on is, why is somebody asking this question? Why is the question of who owns a water right coming up, and sort of look at what the underlying issues are? And it became pretty clear to us that the reason that question was being asked is because somebody wanted to do something with a water right. And the question was, who needed to be notified, who needed to concur with that action. And so we developed this group called the Notice and Concurrence Work Group. And on the back of the testimony, I believe it's on the third page, is a list of the members of that Notice and Concurrence Work Group. And you can see it's a pretty broad representation of the water use stakeholders in the state of Oregon. So what that work group quickly did after probably the first or second meeting was, we quickly identified the issue in terms of notice concurrence and what were the transactions that were transpiring that was raising these ownership issues. And they were quickly identified as voluntary water right cancellations in an irrigation district. So in other words, what's the relationship between the patron who may want to give up their interest in the water right and the rest of the patrons in the district who may be affected and the district as a whole? So that was for water right cancellations. The second topic was allocations of conserved water, where a district may, on behalf of its patrons, initiate a project to line a canal and take the water that they've saved from that canal lining and either put it in stream or on new lands. But the question there was, again, what was the relationship between the district and their decision-making about what to do with that saved water and the rest of the patrons in the district? And the third one was water right transfers, again, sort of begging the question, who has the authority to do what with this water right in terms of the relationship? And I think it's important to point out to the committee that the focus on this group was really about the relationship between the patrons as it relates to other patrons in the district and as it relates to the district as a whole. Because, for example, if an individual in a district was to relinquish their interest in a water right and it was no longer available to the district and the other patrons in the district, that could have significant adverse impacts on the district's ability to deliver water to other patrons in the district and to remain viable in terms of their assessment base. And so we really kind of focused on that relationship. The notice and concurrence work group, again on page 3, met 4 or 5 times during the interim, and there were various subcommittees that met numerous times to work through some of the issues. And I do want to tell this committee that there are finished work products that have come out of the work group. There was some administrative rules that were adopted by the Water Resources Commission in October of 2004 that I believe completely resolve the allocation of conserved water issue and what the relationship is between the patrons and the district, which was a huge accomplishment for the group and everyone involved who worked very hard on it. There were also administrative rules regarding water right cancellations in terms of who should be notified and how that process worked. And House Bill 2172, the concepts in the bill, again, relating to how do we handle voluntary water right cancellations within a district. And finally, what the bill does, I'll kind of walk through the specifics, but again, in summary, what it does is that once an individual makes the decision that they're no longer interested in this water right and they submit the documentation to the department stating they're no longer interested in it, before the department were to cancel the water right, under this provision, the district would have an opportunity to pick up the water right and transfer it elsewhere in the district. And as I say, as I've described in my testimony, my written testimony, most members of the Notice and Concurrence Work Group looked at this concept as an equitable solution to the issues underlying this relationship between the district and its patrons. Okay? Specifically, what the bill does, I've got some bullets on the second page of my testimony. Under current law today, an irrigation district has the opportunity, when a water right is subject to forfeiture, that means 5 years of non-use, when that's about to occur under existing law, a district has an opportunity to transfer that water right elsewhere in the district. And what House Bill 2172 does is creates a similar provision in the case of a request to voluntarily cancel the water right. And so if a individual requests to cancel the water right and the district can demonstrate that they manage or deliver that water, before the department formally cancels the water right that's been requested to cancel, the district would have an opportunity to move it elsewhere in the district. And you'll see that in the bill, through the work of the Notice and Concurrence Work Group and some of the concerns of the stakeholders, there's a lot of sideboards on that. For example, the district has to demonstrate that they actually have somewhere to put the water, that they have a list of landowners in the district who have been waiting to receive water, because the concept was not to make irrigation districts in the state of Oregon the water marketing entities. The concept was to ensure, to the extent that we can, that we keep the delivery systems and the assessment bases viable so that those districts can continue to operate. And finally, what the bill lays out as well is that if the district exercises this option to move the water right through the formal process, that under a different body of law in the irrigation district law, the district shall exempt that piece of land from charges and assessments from the district. And so again, some of the people who are wanting to voluntarily cancel the water right, the reason they're doing it may be that they want to get out from under the charges and assessments of the district, and this bill would make it very clear that if the district exercises that option, they shall make sure that those folks get out from underneath those charges and assessments. I'll, in closing, add, in terms of support and opposition, I should make it clear that there was a member of the Notice Concurrence Work Group, Water Watch of Oregon, who I'm sure will testify today, that they didn't agree with the solution, and I'm sure they'll give you an opportunity to understand that. And again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we support the concepts in the bill, but at the same time, we understand that the stakeholders are continuing discussions about the bill, some potential amendments, and at the Chair's direction, we would look forward to continuing those discussions to see if we can develop some consensus amendments. And I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. There are questions? Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Adam, it's been a long time since I've heard any of these, so I'm sorry if I ask questions on material that I should remember and don't. Tell me why somebody would give up their water right.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, I think that's an excellent question. Where this issue really boiled up was down in the Grants Pass Irrigation District. And part of it in that situation was there was a lot of urbanization. Individuals had very, very small water rights that were attached to their property because of subdivisions over time. And they weren't interested in that kind of irrigation, and they weren't interested in being continually assessed by the district for that water right. So that was the kind of example that really heightened kind of, I think, the bigger issue is can that landowner act in a unilateral fashion without some input by the district, because there seems to be a relationship there. So there's not a lot of activity right now for voluntary cancellations in the state of Oregon, except in the Grants Pass Irrigation District, where we've had about 40 in the last several years because of kind of the urbanization issue. And I think, Representative, that raises a really good point, because most people who had a water right of value, and most water rights have a significant value, would probably be going through sort of a market analysis mm-hmm. in their mind about what can I do with this water right? Can I transfer it to the district? Can I transfer it to my neighbor down the road? And how might that work out? So it's not a big practical problem, but it is an important problem that we need to make sure that we address this relationship issue if it were to come up.
Thank you, Adam. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of different questions, but one of the issues is with regards to water rights being property rights, I think, and being attached to specific tracts of land. So are water rights as property rights attached to two specific tracts of land? And are you aware of any case law providing that the owner of a water right within an irrigation district is the district landowner? Right. I don't know if I'm stating that correctly or not, but...
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, I'm always nervous when I use this term, but a water right is a usufructory right, which means, I hope everyone get that.
But
you've got to be very careful when you say that. It's a right to use water, and the statute is very clear that water right is attached to the land. And in fact, the only way, as we've discussed in front of this committee, that you can change that appurtenancy of the water right is by going through a formal process. So it's kind of right, but it's a unique right, and I'm not an attorney, but I think there could be a lot of argument about whether it's a property right or not, and I'm not really here to debate that. But I think the important in trying to answer your question, there's a lot of case law about relationships between districts and water users. A lot of it, unfortunately, is not from the state of Oregon. There is some in the state of Oregon. And I think the problem with that case law is that many different points of view can find what they're looking for. There's a little bit of everything for everyone. And that's part of the beauty of Oregon water law, in a sense. So, Representative, I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, so if I'm not, try me again.
Well, I think you are, but then it, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, thank you. But then it brings up the question, and I think I really kind of had two questions wrapped into one there, but then it brings up the issue, if a person has a water right, but they're within a water district, and it's their water right that basically is part of the district right to disseminate and to use that water, sort of like a sublease, if you will, then really the person that owns that property is the property owner or is the landowner of the district, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure that I can answer that question. I understand what you're saying. I mean, they're a landowner within the district, whether they own. I guess I'm agreeing with you, yes, that they're a landowner within the district. I think there's two important points, and they're kind of a little spin-off from your question, and that is, number one, is that the whole purpose of this work group and the members that were involved in it was to see if we could get at that relationship question, because I believe there's two ways to get at it. One is we could take a case through the courts of the state of Oregon and we can get an answer that way. Maybe there's three ways. A third way is this body could try to decide what that relationship is, but we had a lot of discussion about that last session. And the third one is for the stakeholders to sit down and decide for themselves what that relationship should be and how we can equitably resolve the issues. And as I pointed out earlier, what this bill does not change the playing field in terms of that issue at all. The landowner can unilaterally decide under the provisions of this bill, I no longer want my water right. Okay. And it isn't until they've made that decision, after thinking about all of the marketing aspects that Representative Tomei brings up, mm-hmm. and they submit the paperwork to the state of Oregon, it's only at that point that this bill sort of kicks in and says, given the desire to resolve that relationship in an equitable fashion, let's see if we can leave that water right within the district so they can continue to deliver water to the other patrons of the district.
Okay. Follow up? Then is, so that would, so a water right is transferable? So if I owned a piece of property that had, and I had was exercising a water right on it, and you wanted to buy my piece of property, and you wanted to maintain the water right, I could go to Water Resources Department and transfer at the time of sale, and it would probably be in the agreement, but we would transfer the water right from me to you as the new property owner. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Krummel, in fact, the water right stays with the land regardless of the change in ownership, number one. Number two, you could change the location or use of the water right to a different location through a formal process with the Water Resources Department, yes.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
But that's only if you are part of a district, or that's anyway. I mean, if I had 1,000 acres in Umatilla County, and I had 1,000 acres in what's the county around there? Union County. Union County, and I wanted to transfer my water right from my Umatilla property to my Union property, I could do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krummel, there's, of course, some sideboards on your ability to transfer water rights. One of them would be that you'd have to continue using the same source of water. So if you had a means of conveying it, perhaps that could happen. But you would need to maintain the same source of water. And probably the biggest sideboard is we have to ensure that those kinds of changes don't cause injury to existing water users within the system. But assuming you could pass those tests, water rights are transferable, and we issue about 300 or more orders each year allowing such changes.
Okay, look, I happen to know some people, Mr. Chair, that own property on state line in Oregon, Washington, and they have property on the Oregon side and right across the road. So technically they could, I mean, so in a county kind of situation, what I was pointing out here is that if your properties happen to abut each other, but there was a county line in between, and I wanted to use it on one, I was approved on one property, but I wanted to use it on the other property, I really could, as long as I'm using the same source, as you mentioned. And if they're abutting each other, I probably would use the same source.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, correct. I mean, they're, again, with the sideboards, water rights are fairly freely transferable.
Okay. So then, if I think
we'd have trouble with Washington.
Well, I know we'd have trouble with Washington, but that's why I went back to the county line. So then the name on the water rights certificate determines who owns the right, and is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, that's not always the case, because the water rights certificate may have been issued to a particular individual in 1952 on a piece of property, and that may have changed hands three times. In the state of Oregon, doesn't really have a process in place to continually change the name on the water right. So that's why the state of Oregon is very focused on the appurtenancy of the water right. So we know where the water right is attached to the land, so to speak, and that becomes the most important element in identifying the water right holder. I should add, Mr. Chair and Representative, none of this is without debate or different opinion, and I think you would find people arguing that it's significant that a water right may be in the name of a particular irrigation district, for example, or in the name of the Bureau of Reclamation for a particular irrigation district. So I don't think, you know, there's certainly different opinions about that, but what we really focus on is the land to which it's pertinent. But I think getting back to my theme of the notice of concurrence work group, where the rubber really hits the road is when someone wants to do something with that water right, then you begin to ask the questions, who needs to be involved in that transaction, who needs to be notified, and who needs to concur. And that's what this work group is trying to resolve.
Okay. May I follow up or ask another question, Mr. Chair?
Well, you certainly may.
Is there any, are there any, you know, one of the things that I've heard sort of bantered around a little bit is this idea of a co-ownership. So when a person has a water right, but they're part of a water district, and then there's a co-ownership there with the water district. So do you know of any either anything in the statutes or anything in terms of Oregon case law that holds that an irrigation district is a co-owner of a water right with a property owner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, I can't think of any particular citation in the statute, but I have heard that particularly from the irrigation district interests, and I'm sure they'll testify to this bill, and this may be a more appropriate question for them, but my understanding is that there is some case law out there that talks about sort of the relationship, if you will, between districts and patrons, yes.
Okay. And then another question, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do other, particularly Western states, because this is, you know, one of the things that we're sort of dealing with here a little bit is, you know, Western states, water rights and that sort of thing, which I think is maybe a little different than it is in the East. But do other Western states have this type of a statute that's proposed in the bill in 2172?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, I think the best way to answer this is that when I talk with other Western states about this problem that we're having about water right ownership and the relationship between the districts and patrons, they all look at me funny because most of the states that I'm referring to, Washington and California in particular, basically the district owns the right. And this isn't an issue because the district doesn't, they're not struggling with this kind of relationship issue. They've resolved it a long time ago. I'm not necessarily advocating that that's the way to settle it here in the state of Oregon, but that's certainly how some other states have handled this issue.
Hmm, interesting. And then I think finally, Mr. Chair, if a person, you made the comment that a person wants, you know, that a person might want out of their water, or their charges, excuse me, of the district, and so they would be saying, well, and that's one of the things that the bill allows for, and so they would want to eliminate their water right. Well, what if I'm in the middle of a water district? I own a water right. I don't want to get rid of my water right. I just want to get rid of the district charges and that sort of thing. Basically, what this bill is saying, if I've read it correctly, is that I can't say I want out of the district and maintain my water right. I have to give up my water right if I want out of the district, if I want out, and if I don't want to be under the charges and assessments of the district anymore, I have to give up my water right. I don't have a choice. Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, again, I think that the district's organization could probably answer this question better than I, but there is a different body of law that kind of addresses how someone may exclude themselves from an irrigation district, and I don't know that exclusion necessarily requires them to give up their water right. So I think there could be kind of separate processes. What this bill is saying is that if you want to give up the interest in your water right and the district decides to move it elsewhere, that as a kind of a quid pro quo, the district shall get you out from under those charges and assessments. And again, Representative, the Irrigation District Association can probably give you more information about how the exclusion from a district process works.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
I think this has been implied in the discussion that you've been having with Representative Crummell, but I just want to make certain that I understand it. If a water right is transferred from one piece of land to a different piece of land, either under the same ownership or under different ownership, the water right is now appurtenant to the new piece of land. Is that right or not?
Chair Jensen, Representative Barnhart, that's correct.
Thank you. I just wanted to finish the dissertation so that I was certain I understood it. Thank you, sir.
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I should add that through the process, if we want to get really technical, it's severed from parcel A, it's moved to parcel B, and after that individual demonstrates that they've actually developed the water right on parcel B, it becomes appurtenant to parcel B.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Adam, this bill just deals with a water right that's moved within that water district. If you were wanting to move the water right outside of the district, it wouldn't be applicable.
Mr. Chair and Representative Brown, that's correct. There's a number of sideboards in this bill, and it simply would allow to change the place of use of that water right to somewhere within the district boundaries. That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Are there other questions for Adam?
I have one question, I guess. The one issue I think you haven't addressed as we kind of walked around this statute, and that is,
what about the owner of a piece of land with a water right that's outside of the district? Since the prevailing law in Oregon is kind of a prior appropriation sort of thing. If we've got an owner outside of the district that is secondary to the individual that is wanting to get rid of this water right for whatever reason, but is senior to everybody else in the district, and under the normal course of thing, during dry years, which next summer may be one that we're looking at, that person would have the first call on that water right. Whereas in your proposal, that would basically be taken away from them. Is that, am I reading this correctly?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I think that's a very good point that was discussed at some length with the notice of concurrence work group. And I think the example is that if someone were to voluntarily cancel their water right, that could result in a benefit to someone downstream of the district. And one of the things that we talked about in the group, Mr. Chair, I think this gets back to kind of the question that Representative Tomei was asking, is why would somebody voluntarily cancel their water right? And one of the things that I think the group quickly tumbled to in the scenario that you just described is that sounds like a water right with a fair amount of value to somebody. And likely, and I know I'm not answering your question directly yet, but likely those two individuals would have some meeting of the minds and probably work out a scenario to transfer that water right to that individual's benefit. That may or may not happen. But I think the point that you raised, Mr. Chair, is a very legitimate issue. What the committee focused on was the relationship between the patrons within the district as it relates to each other and to the district as a whole. Because I could very easily paint a different example, different hypothetical example, where the voluntary cancellation that we're talking about would result in the district's inability to deliver water to somebody at the end of the ditch, who in fact may be the senior water right holder of all the people in our example. Or could be a situation where the assessment base has dropped to the point where they no longer can operate the district. And it was really that example, Mr. Chair, the viability of the district to continue delivering water and to continuing the management of the district is what the group focused on, Mr. Chair.
The chair understands the examples or the issue you're bringing up. However, it doesn't answer the question as far as the upstream user. And just as a note to all current and future testifiers on this and against this, that's a issue that needs to be resolved in the chair's mind before he's real enthusiastic about the bill, I guess. So, and I think, and I do agree, I understand that we're working, maybe almost as we speak, you know, trying to come up with resolutions, you know, to the issues that are out there. I am inclined to ask you all to keep working before we get to a work session on this bill. And I appreciate, you know, the work you've done. I want to, sorry I wasn't here when you came up, but I had to testify on another bill. And I want to thank you, and I want to thank the members of the work group for, you know, the efforts that were put in here. And I don't want in any way for this to seem like the chair is not appreciative of those. And we are dealing with, you know, that very delicate issue of ownership. That's one that causes all of us a lot of concern. And we've had a lot of sometimes stressful sessions talking about that, and I suppose we'll continue to do that, but somewhere along the line I think we'll find a solution that, and wording that will, or a compromise that will cover our, you know, all of our needs with it. At least I'm optimistic that that will take place. So thank you, Adam, unless you have, if you have concluding comments or remarks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess I would just add that the chair is right that we've had some difficult debates over this, but I think the good news is that at the chair's direction, we have worked very hard to get the stakeholders to understand each other's concerns. Mm-hmm. We've taken the allocation of conserved water issue off the table. I think we're very close on the voluntary cancellation issue. And I think I'm pleased to report that I think we're making good progress. And I appreciate your keeping us our feet to the fire to get that done, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And thanks for your hard work on this, Adam. I appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, can I just make a comment about Adam?
Oh, I don't know.
I just want to say how much I appreciate, because Adam is always smiling, and I think that he should get sort of kudos for counseling as well in this process. So we'll make
thank
sure
you.
And let your boss know.
Mr. Myers, please. Good afternoon, Doug.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Doug Myers, and I'm here representing Water Watch. And I should just tell you right up, I was not a member of the work group. Carolyn Russell was, and regrets that she cannot be here talk about the bill. So I'm not the expert in this, and she wrote this testimony, and I'll do my best, okay? Water Watch is opposed to House Bill 2172 as currently printed. And I put on that little thing at the end because, as the chair is talking about, we are in active negotiations with the proponents of the bill and hope to reach some agreement. Members of the committee, I commend you for your questions on who owns water. That is an extremely divisive thing amongst the agricultural community, I have to tell you. Water Watch is mainly interested in water being left in stream for pollution abatement, for just looking at it, for fish, things like that in the first paragraph. And water is defined as being owned by the public. If a landowner within a district doesn't want to have the water anymore, they can voluntarily cancel the right, and the water would then revert back to the public. And the public might be a senior water right user downstream from the district. It could be a senior water right within the district. It could be an in-stream water right with a priority date that is senior to other things. And that is who the water would go to. Cancellation of a water right can also free up water for other uses other than agriculture. House Bill 2172 would allow irrigation districts to capture water that a landowner seeks to voluntarily return to the public for appropriation, and I should tell you that there are people within irrigation districts, most notably the Grants Pass Irrigation District in years past and present, who want to relinquish their water right and have it flow in stream. And before about a year and a half ago, the district vigorously fought that, and there were, I think, about three or four elections down there, and the direction of the water Grants Pass Irrigation District would swing one way and swing another, and now it's with help from Greg Walden, congressman for that district, and others. That's now resolved, and I think we've reached some good accommodation in the Grants Pass Irrigation District. When reviewing this bill, Water Watch asks the following questions. One, does the bill protect Oregon's rivers and their inhabitants today and for future generations? Two, does the bill provide accountability so that water users and administrative agencies act responsibly with this public resource? Three, does the bill promote public participation? And Water Watch is big on public participation, so that Oregonians have a real say in how our rivers are managed. And as the bill is presently written, answers no to all three. First, the bill actually makes it less likely that water will be put in stream to meet public needs. Instead of the unused water returning to the public domain, a district could preempt reallocation of the water to the public and move the water to other lands within the district. I sometimes refer to this bill as printed, as well, once water gets within an irrigation district, it never leaves. The state, not the water district, should decide where the water should be allocated. Second, if the state wishes to pursue a policy of allowing the capture of water in about to be canceled water rights, it should ensure that public benefits results from the real allocation by dedicating the water, or at least a healthy proportion of that water, in stream for fish, wildlife, recreation, water quality, and other public uses of the water in stream. Third, the public would not have notice and opportunity to comment or protest the district's proposed capture of the council water rights. Under the bill, it appears that only users in the district whose rights are to be transferred and who are to receive the transferred right get notice of the transfer, and that only they are entitled to protest the transfer. Finally, this approach ignores changing land use patterns across Oregon. Across the state, agricultural lands within irrigation districts are becoming urbanized, reducing agricultural uses of the water. This is especially true in Grants Pass and the Deschutes, other places. The Grants Pass Irrigation District doesn't have a lot of irrigated agriculture in it. It's mainly what I call horsey farms, 5 to 10 acres, where you have a cow and a horse and recollect what Granddad used to do back 50 years ago. By allowing irrigation districts to capture this water, as land use practices change, the state is in effect allowing irrigation districts to become brokers of this public resource. This ignores the public nature of the resource and favors irrigation districts at the expense of all other competing needs for the water. In sum, we oppose House Bill 2172 as printed because it will undermine ongoing efforts to protect and restore Oregon's rivers and shuts the public and affected water right holders out of the process. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about the bill.
Thank you, Doug. Are there questions for Mr. Meyer?
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Are these all set? We have Katie Fast. Is it Kate Teisel? Is it Teisel?
Teisel.
Okay. And Anita? Yeah. Please go ahead, okay. Katie.
For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. During the interim, I participated on the department's notice and concurrence work group, and cancellation was one of the three issues that we focused on. And I believe strongly as participants on the work group, we worked to try to find a reasonable compromise that the majority of the stakeholders would agree upon. But with that, there isn't a however. And due to some concerns from our county farm bureaus, we readdressed House Bill 2172. And the main concerns from our membership surrounded around that this bill was truly not a cancellation bill, but possibly a transfer bill, because the water was never canceled to the point where a landowner could cancel their water and it went back into the public domain and the prior appropriation system. And secondly, it was just directly transferred and remained in the district. And that can be seen if you just look at the relating clause of the bill. It states relating to transfers of water rights within the districts, and that raised a large concern with our membership. And then the The second concern surrounded around possible impacts to the prior appropriation doctrine of Western water law and making that water available to junior users in the system. With that, Oregon Farm Bureau has readdressed the bill and is trying to shop around to other stakeholders some possible amendments to get feedback on and maybe work for a solution that will meet our concerns and other concerns, I think, that you'll hear later on today. We have some draft amendments. They may not be in the perfect format, nor do we have support from others yet on that, but we're trying to address it. Those amendments would try to make the bill a notification bill instead of a transfer bill. It would, for one, require the department to notify an irrigation district when they receive a cancellation application for water rights within the district. Second, the department would not act on that cancellation for 90 days to allow time for landowners within the district to negotiate a possible transfer of the water rights to other lands within the district, putting it more into a free market reign that we had talked about earlier with Representative Tomei's question. Thirdly, the irrigation district shall notify patrons who are waiting for water within the district or that they know are wanting to transfer water onto new lands. Looking at requiring the department to place notice of the cancellation in their weekly notice published by the department and also in area newspapers. And I think that's consistent with other parts of the statute dealing with transfers. So those are some possible amendments that we'd like to present to the committee and to other stakeholders and possibly request this goes to either a work group or allow us time to try to build some consensus among the stakeholders and bring some amendments forward to the committee. And I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Katie.
Question.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Katie, what if I were the holder of a water right and I wanted to cancel my water right, but I wanted it to go into the stream? Under your amendments, would that be allowed?
Representative Jensen, Representative Tomei, it would and would not, and I'll probably give you a long answer like you've been getting all day. With this, you would not be required to have that water remain in the district or transferred to other lands within the district. However, it would go into the public or the prior appropriations doctrine. So if there are junior users in the system who had not been fully utilizing their water rights, they would be able to pick that up. That could possibly be an in-stream right. It could be another irrigator or another water user. Or possibly the final option is if it's an under-appropriated system, it might be available for someone else to apply for as a new water right.
The answer is no.
What?
The answer is no.
it's a no and possibly a yes.
But can I just follow up with that, Mr. Chair?
I would just make the observation that that's why we have courts. And
Just follow up. In most instances, though, in-stream water rights are going to be junior, very junior. Is that correct?
Representative Dingfelder, yes, and the most of the times the in-stream water rights are going to be junior rights if it was a state-applied water right. However, Oregon Water Trust and other nonprofits, when they're purchasing in-stream water rights, they do try to find the most senior right that's up for sale. I think there's a mixture within the state, but the majority of them are junior rights.
Well, could I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Because help me understand this, maybe Katie or anybody, but I can imagine someone buying property, having a water right, and they feel very strongly that the stream needs more water because of fish, all kinds of reasons, maybe because of the Oregon plan, et cetera. And so that might be their choice, that that's how they want to spend their water. That's how they want it to be spent, to be used, where they want it to go. So why wouldn't that be their right to do that?
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, they would actually not cancel their right. If that was their intent, they would transfer that water in stream, and those transfers are dealt with in a different statute, and this bill or our possible amendments or what happens with this bill would not impact the in-stream water right transfers.
Okay. Thank you, Katie.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll get to you on that question in a minute. Other questions? Okay.
Kate Kiesel with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association.
Thank you, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. My name is Kate Kiesel with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. The Oregon Cattlemen's Association is opposed to House Bill 2172 as it is written, because it would take away landowners' ability to truly cancel their water rights, and it contradicts the doctrine of prior appropriation. If House Bill 2172 were amended to only require notification when a voluntary water right cancellation is requested, the cattlemen would prefer that all water right holders be notified. However, we could live with any amendments that just require irrigation districts and their patrons to be notified. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Kay. Question? Okay. Anita.
Good afternoon, Chair Jensen.
So far, the distinction of being the outside layers. You Adam starts out on the pro. We get all the and then you're coming along again. I think on the pro on this, if I'm reading your testimony correctly.
Not unlike an Oreo cookie sometimes. But I'm not sure black and white, good, bad. I'm not going to make that distinction about this. So. Chair Jensen and members of the Water Committee, my name is Anita Winkler, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. I think this is the first time I've had a chance to be before the committee this year, and I guess I would say I'm glad to be here. The Oregon Water Resource Congress is a trade association that represents the irrigation districts and other what I call water delivery systems that serve irrigated agriculture in Oregon. I'm not going to go through my testimony in detail. You can read it at your leisure. It's obvious this isn't going to be gone today, and you'll have some time to look at it a little further. But I want to make a couple of points. The first is, as Adam very eloquently articulated, this bill came out of the Notice and Concurrence Work Group, and there's a lot of people in this room, including Katie and I, who sat on that through Adam said many meetings, and he used to actually have a count, but we lost count somewhere along the way because we met as often as every other week during the interim, during some months. This was one of three work products that came out of that. The other two, as Adam mentioned, have come to fruition through some rulemaking, and this is, some have described it kind of the third leg on the stool. I'm not sure I would call it the third leg on the stool because I'm not sure if the stool collapses if any one of the other pieces is gone, but it was three pieces of work that took a lot of time and effort and commitment on the part of that work group. Having said that, one of the reasons that we're supporting the bill is because it came out of that work group and it took a lot of hours and time and effort during the interim, and I very much want to respect the effort of that group. But the other reason that we support it is the substance of the bill. We think that this bill has merit. We think it supports irrigation districts and their need to have some certainty in how they continue to serve their patrons. I don't remember if it was Adam or one of the committee members alluded to the ongoing issue of the need to have water to move water. And as water is transferred out of an irrigation district or lost to the district, pretty soon you don't have water to move water to the last guy on the ditch. Representative Jensen asked the question about the senior water rights and the relationship between senior water rights in a district and more senior or less senior outside of a district. And I fully understand your question, and I wish I had a magic answer, but I don't. But the other side of that, or a different scenario, is the senior water right holders inside the district who suddenly can't get their water rights because of these kinds of cancellations, where the water is then moving to junior water rights holders outside the district. So the seniors no longer get their water because there's no transportation water or the district isn't financially solvent, but the junior guys outside the district are getting water because these rights were canceled and they, so to speak, trickle down to the less in a seniority order. So it's kind of hard to describe how that works. The Grants Pass issue, several people have talked about, that was, I've been with this organization 3.5 years, and it was several years before I came on board, and it seems to have developed kind of its own mystique and legend. But it was a real awful, awful fight, and it was ugly, and I don't think anybody's happy with what happened. In the end, the district, the water users canceled their water rights, and the district was faced with some pretty tough decisions, especially on a financial basis. But as I understand the underlying issue there, these were water users who indeed had access to domestic supply of some sort to irrigate what bits of land that they had, and they understandably didn't want to pay for that domestic water that I think was just part of like the municipal delivery system, and pay the charges to the irrigation district. You know, none of us would disagree that that's pretty untenable and pretty hard to swallow. This bill would take care of exactly that kind of a problem. If the water user, the landowner, doesn't want to be part of the district anymore, doesn't want to get district water, has no use for that water right, they can cancel the water right. And this bill lets them do exactly that through a process. They no longer would be subject to the district charges. So it solves that problem that was underlying in Grants Pass. Frankly, this bill doesn't solve the rest of Grants Pass's problem because there is no additional land in that district on which to place this water. So it will be gone to the district for that district. This doesn't solve every district's issues, but it addresses an issue for a large number of districts. So having said all of that, we have had a series of meetings. Katie and I have developed a close and personal working relationship on this thing over the last several weeks, trying to work out some language that resolves the issues raised by her members. And I think we're getting quite close. We're not there yet. The language that's in her testimony today has some pieces that I haven't seen before, but that's kind of how this has worked. Is, you know, we both deal with committees of people from throughout the state, and they're sometimes kind of hard to get hold of. But we just keep working back and forth, and I think we're probably within a few days of having something that we both can work with. So I want to reiterate that I support the bill as it is in front of you, but we're perfectly willing to continue trying to work through the disagreements and see if we can bring something back with agreement. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Anita. And in case you've missed the chair's comments about the work group and the work that has taken place on the part of all of the members of the work group that met during the interim, I'd like to reiterate them to make sure that you're aware of my appreciation of the work that you've done and of the difficulty of the problem. I mean, this is not necessarily an easy problem for us to deal with, as we found out in the last couple of sessions now, as we've kind of, you know, waltzed around this issue. But then, you know, as we started, you will remember on the first day of the committee meeting, members, that we had the motto of the Oregon House Water Committee, that whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. So, you know, we are adhering to that age-old now thing. So I do appreciate it. Are there any questions for Anita? I would, if none others, I'd like to, I mean, the question of this transfer for in-stream rights, we've got within a water district. If somebody wants to transfer their water right for an in-stream use, and the transfer to take place at the point of diversion, which would obviously affect the flow of the ditch or pipe or whatever it was. What are the provisions in law, and what would the districts do in relationship to this?
As I understand, and Adam may want to correct me, I hope I get it right in the first shot here, the landowner can go ahead and make that transfer. And right now, the district has no ability to stop it. And you're getting to kind of the last piece of the notice and concurrence work group where we didn't get the thing quite resolved. This is a very sticky issue, and we got into the issue of how do you keep the district functioning, when something might injure or harm the district. And we worked, a lot of groups worked independently. We worked in outside meetings, and we haven't come to a resolution of that particular issue. So that one is yet to come.
Okay. Can I bring Adam up for just a half a second? You can stay there if you wish, Anita, but if we're not dealing with a water district and you want to transfer your water right in stream, what are the provisions here? If you're not in a district, you're just an individual.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, under the current law, I believe the term is that the holder of a water right may, through an application process with the department, transfer their water right in stream to a different place, to a different type of use. So that's a provision in law.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just add, so that I think it provides some context for how far this group has come in terms of the understanding of the issue.
Okay. I need to go on a little bit more, though. I think as far as the committee is concerned, on this issue, and basically in either the case of the district or the individual. The in-stream water right transfer has the appropriation date of the land that the water right was appurtenant to at the time. Is that correct?
Yes.
However, as contrasted to the situation where an individual gives up, their water right, sort of thing. If somehow or another this water right now is transferred in stream, it takes on a new appropriation date, doesn't it? I mean, if Water Watch comes in and wants, or somebody else comes in and wants to get this water right, and it's been given up, it's gone.
Yes.
And if it's it takes a new water right, and that water right would have at today's date on it, or whatever that was. So it would be a very junior right, as contrasted to a transferred right that might be a 1909 or something water right. Does that make sense for us? That was just a clarification I was looking for for us on the committee. It seemed to me, as I was listening, maybe to be a little uncertainty on that issue.
Mr. Chair, can I have a follow-up on that, please?
You may.
In regards to, Adam, leasing water rights, if an irrigation district, if a member of an irrigation district, Mr. Chair prompted this question in my head, decided that they wanted to lease for a limited amount of time, that they weren't going to, grow crops for a certain amount of time, and they wanted to lease for 5 years to the Oregon Water Trust, for instance, would they have to get permission from the irrigation district to do that, or can they do that on their own with a transaction with the Oregon Water Trust?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, under the rules of the Water Resources Commission, the district's required to actually be a co-applicant if the water right is within a district and it's going to be leased in stream.
Okay. And is that common practice? I mean, do most irrigation districts agree to do that? I'm just not familiar with leasing within irrigation districts. Anita, do you know?
Is it common? I don't know. Is it something that becomes a source of contention with the district? I don't believe so. I don't know off the top of my head, and it's all anecdotal, but any district has stood in the way of somebody who wanted to lease their water in stream.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate very much your hard work on this bill, and I appreciate your testimony this afternoon. Thank you kindly.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Anita one question?
You thought you were getting away.
Sure. Go ahead, Representative Rumble.
Thank you. You had mentioned, and I think if I was following correctly, you had mentioned about people pulling out of water districts and what happens if it becomes difficult for the water district to stay afloat, no pun intended. Is it possible that water districts, you know, outlive their usefulness in a particular instance and maybe should be disbanded or should be eliminated?
Chair Jensen and Representative Crummell, I would have to say that's possible, but irrigation districts were created, they're public entities, they're special districts. They were created under state law by the landowners at the time who went through an organization process. And if it's time for it to not exist anymore, there's a very formal process and statute for dissolving the district. And I'd have to go back, but I haven't looked at that in a long, long time. But I think it has to take formal action of the board and formal action of the landowners. But there is a process to do that. And in all honesty, there's probably a couple districts in the state that are on the border of that as urbanization is encroaching into ag land. But they haven't quite reached that point. It just has seemed unfair to us that that happens because when there's still a desire on the part of the existing irrigators to keep the district there to serve them, that something going on with the water rights and movement of water rights forces them into that situation. But I also have to say that in the districts where that is likely to happen, this bill probably would not help them because there probably isn't any more land available to which you could move these water rights, in which case they would just go on through the cancellation process.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Carlson? Thank you.
Good afternoon, Richard.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Richard Kosa, Sand Water for Life.
As short as you want to make it.
What an invitation.
I take that as sound advice. As currently drafted, Water for Life is opposed to House Bill 2172 for a number of reasons. I think they have been identified with previous speakers. I have distributed a copy of House Bill 2539, however. This bill was introduced and widely debated not 2 years ago, but 4 years ago. And I think this was one of the first bills in recent sessions, anyway, that gave rise to the debate over who owns, who controls a water right. You'll see a great degree of similarity between 2539 and 2172. But I think for just the very quick, brief arguments, we believe that 2172 is inconsistent with how we allocate water in western states. It clearly is front and center addressing the ownership issue. And I think finally, it's probably an unnecessary piece of legislation. If an individual patron wanted to cancel his or her right, the district, clearly without the legislation, could negotiate with that patron to find perhaps mutual ground. And I think that is one consideration that's not been yet addressed. With that, Mr. Chair, and your advice, I hope that was short enough.
Representative Dinkelder has a question, however, that may...
It'll be brief, Richard.
Okay.
Are you involved at all working with the drafters of the amendments? Do you have any amendments that you propose, or you just your wish would be that the bill just goes away?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dinkelder, yes and no. We have talked briefly and informally with some individuals, stakeholders, in terms of potential amendments. There was one concept floating around in terms of a notification provision that in case a patron wanted to cancel his or her right, notification would simply be made If that notification extends to individuals inside the district boundaries, as well as perhaps more senior appropriators outside the district boundaries, that perhaps is a workable avenue. But if notification is provided only to the district and the patrons inside, you could disenfranchise very easily somebody more senior outside that district, and that's one of our concerns.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Richard, and for you and for the other folks who were here testifying pro and con. I really would like to encourage and ask you to keep working, try to get us something that we can all agree with, you know, on this that basically, you know, tries to deal with the issues. And I know we're not going to get, you know, an immediate amendment to this that is going to solve for time immemorial the definition of who owns the water right, but we may be able to come up with something on this. And if you can, and if we reach that stage, why, maybe we'll call a task force and get a room that we can go to our former chair of the judiciary from 2 years ago and see if he's got a room that we can put you in to keep you there until we come up with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks very much. I really do appreciate all of your work and efforts on this. And with this, we're going to roll over until Friday the public hearing on House Bill 2178. And so we're going to close our public hearing then on 2172 and 2178 for today. And we're going to open a work session on House Bill 2083. And staff will read the bill, read the material on 2083.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2083, you will recall we had a public hearing from the Water Resources Department on January 28th. This eliminates the requirement that a seller of the property with a water right notify the Water Resources Department when it is for sale. It also repeals the requirement that that person owning the property on which the well is drilled record the information on the well in deed records, on the deed records, and then it repeals the provision relating to water use registration when the use is for wetland, stream or riparian restoration, or stormwater management. There was no testimony in opposition, and there are no amendments.
And has anyone... you will recall we had this before. We announced at the time that our reason for not holding a work session then was to hold bills over at least, for a couple of days, so that if there were things came up that came to our mind after we had heard the testimony, we'd have a chance to deal with that. And at this point, I would entertain a motion to move this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummel.
I'll move House Bill 2083 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Crummel has moved House Bill 2083 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any questions, and is there any discussion?
I have one question.
Question.
Adam, I think. Sorry, Adam. It's your day. He deserves a bottle of whiskey after the work group. Could you, and I apologize because I think I missed this part of the discussion, so, or I need refreshing. Can you just remind me about the reasoning for repealing the provision relating to the water use registration for stream restoration or wetland enhancement?
For the record. Adam Sussman, Water Resources Department. Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, the answer is quite simple. When this provision was passed by the legislature in 1993, the department had a significant backlog, and there was a concern that earth-friendly projects were getting stuck in the department's backlog. And so this was an opportunity to move those forward by having a registration and permitting process. Since that time, we've eliminated the backlog. We've got statutory timelines for processing permits, and we've got new tools, particularly the limited license, which is actually a better and faster tool to get these projects moved ahead, and the alternate reservoir process as well, Representative. It's
okay.
simply not needed anymore.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Adam.
You're welcome.
Did we have a motion?
We have a motion.
Yeah. I move the House Bill 2083 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. If there's no other questions, the clerk will call the roll for it, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Dalto?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dingfelder?
Aye.
Vice Chair Primmel?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye. House Bill 2083 passed with unanimous recommendation. I would entertain a motion to put it on the consent calendar.
So moved.
Is there any objection? So ordered. Close the work session on House Bill 2083 and open the work session on 2123. Staff will read the bill and the...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, we had a public hearing on House Bill 2123 on January 28th. This, too, relates to the Water Resources Department, and it directs the Water Resources Commission to adopt rules for modifying certificates of registration of rights to appropriate groundwater, and directs the Commission to establish fees, which are not to exceed $500, for this action. It also repeals the sunset on the current consent to injury provisions relating to water uses subject to a transfer, and it has an emergency clause. Also want to let you know that attached to your SMS, we did get a fiscal impact statement. This bill does not have a prior reference to ways and means, and we don't have any sort of a threshold. Anything that has a fiscal impact needs to go to Ways and Means, so our motion will need to reflect a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. However, this is also anticipated in the governor's budget. The agency put it in their budget, their 0507 budget, so it did not come as a surprise.
Chair would entertain a motion to pass House Bill 2123 with subsequent referral to the Ways and Means with a subsequent referral to the House Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder moves. Is there any question or discussion on this?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
This establishes a new fee or creates a...
For the record, Adam Sussman with the Water Resource Department, Representative Jensen and Representative Brown. This opportunity to modify a groundwater registration is very similar to a water right transfer, and it creates an additional workload for the department. So this bill requires that if you want this kind of modification, there would be a fee associated with it, and that fee would allow the department to manage this new potential workload. Yes.
Thank you, Adam. Mr. Chair, how come it doesn't have to refer to revenue then?
That it just refers to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a point of clarification, please? Also.
Point of clarification, Representative Dingfelder?
Well, Adam, you already charge a fee for surface water transfers. Is that correct?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct.
So now this would provide a fee for groundwater transfers.
Okay.
That's what I'm just trying to figure out, so it's more in a level playing field.
Yeah, Mr. Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, that is correct that this would be similar in process to a water right transfer, which does require a fee.
Are you happy or satisfied with this is just what I'm told it goes to.
Oh, that's why I operate too, Mr. Chair. I do what I'm told. It's creating a new fee. It says it's creating a new fee. And I thought those bills generally went to the Revenue Committee for review.
Representative Brown, the chair is going to hold the work session over on this bill until Friday, so that we clarify that point. We will remember we do have a motion on the floor, or on the bill, so we don't have to repeat that. We'll just get that issue clarified on Friday and move the bill in according to whether we need to amend the motion or whether the motion is appropriate as stands.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, we are adjourned.